I'm Esther. I'm the young evangelist.
And you guessed it, I'm Frank.
So, 20 years, hey. In the year 1994, I was 5 years old. And Windows 1.0 had been out for about 10 years. It took 10 years, but the world was finally becoming familiar with the GUI. And the PC was a part of common vernacular. Apparently, in 1994, file sharing was done on floppy disks on the cover of magazines. And here's an interesting fact for you all. There were 54 million mobile phones in the world. In 1994, Windows for Workgroups 3.11 was in market, and a tough kid by the name of NT 3.51 was just released. We also announced Windows 95. We're on the way to making TCP IP networking and client-server computing mainstream. And you developers had a choice. Visual Fox Pro, Visual Basic, Visual Source Safe, Access 2.0, and Visual C++. Computer graphics were becoming consumer level. And the UIT pros were busy rolling out desktop PCs. And hey, we had the first tech ed here in Australia. It was in Sydney, in a hotel, and there were about 300 people there. That's probably the first 7.22 rows down there. Mick and Vaughan remember that.
My first tech ed back in 1994 was an amazing experience. It was the first time that I'd seen so many people with similar interests, and that was amazing.
My first tech ed was the first tech ed in Australia, 1994, and it was a very different tech ed from what you see today. There were only 300 or 400 people. It was at a hotel in Sydney, but it was really the only way you could get the new information. You could read a magazine, you could go to a user group, but really, to get it from the horse's mouth, you had to go to tech ed.
One great experience I always remember was sitting in a bus next to this guy I just met, and we were developing a very similar solution. I was in Sydney and he was in Adelaide, and we were exchanging ideas all the way down.
It was a time where you could go and really get inspired by the things that were happening in the industry and the new things that were happening with the technology.
The single best thing I've got from Tech Ed has been the friendships.
I came away from Tech Ed feeling as though I was in the right place, I was doing the right thing, and the direction the company was going was fantastic, and I met a whole bunch of people who were feeling the same way, and it really changed my life.
So as you can see, I've been to a tech ed or two in my time.
My favourite bit of tech ed memorabilia is actually my very first tech ed bag. This is from 1994. It takes me back to the time when things were perhaps simpler.
So 10 years later, it's 2004, and boy, what a difference a decade makes. You know, I haven't changed much since, don't you think? You know, that's me, 2004. So, if we look back from 2004, what had come before that? It was all about .NET. We'd launched .NET a few years earlier. Visual Studio.NET was the premium developer environment. It consolidated all those different tools. Networking, client server, WAN, and internet was all built into the development tools that we now had. We saw the introduction of the Windows Server System. There was hardware acceleration on the client. It took 10 years to hit 1.7 billion phones worldwide. Suffice to say, shitloads had happened in those preceding 10 years. So what had happened in 2004? Well, it was the year of Windows XP SP2. Who remembers that, right? We saw the introduction of the Microsoft Office system, and Windows Server 2003 was in the market. We had DirectX 9 out on the client, and we had seen the introduction of tablet PCs already. You know, I still remember my Toshiba M200 from 2004. Programming for the web was also a reality. It was all about web services. Who remembers XML web services, right? Way of getting data. It took a decade, 10 years, to get that level of change. And Tech Ed? Well, Tech Ed in 2004 was in Canberra. And Tatum and Catherine remember.
My first impression of Tech Ed was how overwhelmingly big it was. There was so many people, so much information to take in.
My first tech ed, I was 17 years old. I'd been going to user groups before that, but this was my first major technology event that I'd been to. So it was pretty amazing getting in and seeing 3,000 people who all dealt with technology as well and getting to chat to lots of people.
When I first went to tech ed, I was working for myself. It was a massive endeavour. I actually had a 6-month-old baby, and the challenges around managing the contracts and the work that I had, and even having my husband bring my son in so that I could feed him during tech ed sessions, was absolutely nothing in comparison to the return of attending tech ed.
There are some of the people who I met at my very first tech ed who I'm still in regular contact with now, see them every couple of weeks. And they're great people to know. There's also people who I might only see them each year at TechEd, that once every 12 months. And that's just a great opportunity to catch up with them as well.
A lot of the content that, in terms of training, you can read in a book or you can pick up from watching a video, but it's the people that you meet and those experiences they share with you at TechEd that make it really valuable.
I've always had an interest in speaking and talking to audiences and being able to share a lot of the experiences that I do have in my day-to-day work. And TechEd was the first opportunity I had to get up in that forum.
One of my funniest memories of TechEd was the first TechEd I attended, and the after party was at Home Nightclub, and Fran Garrigo wasn't allowed in.
One of the bits of memorabilia that I still have from TechEd is my little Channel 9 guy. I remember the year that they launched Channel 9, and these were quite a prized possession to get your hands on.
Before I went to TechEd, I thought I was the smartest person in the room. And then I went to TechEd and realised I was the smartest person in the room.
So within 5 years, by 2009, programming for the web was ubiquitous. Laptops were outselling desktops, and everyone was connected. All this major movement happened in just 5 years. Monumental shifts that were once taking 10 years were now only taking five. In 2009, we hit 4.6 billion phones. That's 300% more in those 5 years than in the previous 10. And in 2009, Windows 7 and Windows Server 2000 R2 were released. Windows 7 was evaluated by 8 million beta testers. We also saw the release of IE8, Hyper-V, Azure, and Bing. And Kinect, codenamed Project Natal, was being cooked up in the labs. We also had TechEd here on the Gold Coast. Mick and Vaughan remember that one.
My first impression of TechEd in 2009 was I was overwhelmed with the scale of the event. There was just so many people there and so many smart people there.
Obviously, being up on the Gold Coast, it was a welcome break in late winter to be up there, but it's just the buzz and the feeling. 2009 was a fairly big year, so it was a year that all the delegates picked up our netbooks, and so there was a big buzz around everyone unboxing a new piece of kit and getting a fairly early look at Windows 7.
I think the most valuable thing I've taken from TechEd is the relationships with the people that I meet. I now know who the experts are on certain topics, and I can just connect with them immediately.
If I look at everything that I've taken away from TechEd over the years, certainly the thing that helps my business the most is being able to get a high-level view of all of the technologies that are being released and are out in the current year.
Most memorable night I've had at TechEd probably would have been the party at Dreamworld, being there with, you know, thousands of people on roller coasters having a great time all night.
Everyone was excited about the week ahead. It was a week of knowledge, a week of learning, a week of networking. And it was the first time I really got to sit down with some of my peers in other organisations and understand that we're facing the same challenges and we're solving the same problems and really get that sense of community.
Before I went to TechEd, I thought I was the smartest person in the room, and it turns out that, yeah, Catherine's the smartest person in the room.
So we're now at 2013. Windows XP's looking pretty run down. The bliss, right? Looks familiar. So, 2013, what's happened? Well, IT pros are managing hundreds of clouds, of private virtual servers in the cloud. The mobile world is embraced. It's a mobile-first world. We're seeing a common kernel across Windows, Windows Phone. Windows 8 was released a year ago, and we've seen over 100 million licenses. We've seen over 100,000 apps in the store. We've seen over 250 million apps downloaded. Now, less than 1 year later, we're about to see Windows 8.1 be released. We're talking about the release in October. Windows 8.1 brings hundreds of new features, 4,900 new APIs for developers, enterprise management features, better personalization, better search, improved store, shitload of features. That's less than 1 year. So think about it. What used to take 10 years took 5 years. What took 5 years took 3 years. Now what took 3 years is taking 1 year. Things are speeding up. If you blink, you will miss it based on this speed. And with that, I'll introduce Michael Kordahi to help you understand how to take it forward. The svelte, Michael Kordahi.
Welcome. 20 years of TechEd. How awesome. Who was here at their first TechEd? Who was here at the first Tech Ed in 1994. Yes, you, and you're still alive. What a good day for you, sir. 20 years of Tech Ed. Frank was here, Andrew was here, Jeff was here, and they'll all tell you the same thing has happened over those last 20 years. And that is more. There will always be more pixels on a screen. There will always be more releases. There will always be more technology. There'll always be more compute power. There'll always be more to learn. There'll always be more to deploy. There'll always be another tech ed. That speed of which things are happening is why we love this stuff. It's the reason you're here. You love the fact that every year you get to play with the shiny new thing. You get to come here and learn the shiny new things. And that kind of keeps us moving. Let's take a bit of a history lesson. What has happened over the last 20 years? Who remembers this? A moment of silence for her, please. Oh, that was the sound of ASCII art. That's it. That's the moment when you're almost there. And we're about to. And it always took too long, didn't it? There we go. That was the sound of ASCII art. That was the sound of cute cats on the internet. 56K modem. This is almost real time. Guess how long that would have taken on a 56K? You wouldn't have dared, by the way. That's a 1080 screen. Never. 56K modem, that would have been a 45-second download. 45-second download. 10 years. Fast forward, there's our cute cat. 10 years, fast forward, and bam. Look at that. That's ADSL 1 in all its glory. 10 years later, we went to 1.5... Oh, yeah, it's 2004, so it's a lolcat, of course, right? So, 10 years later, we got to 1.4 meg from 56K. Took a whole 10 years. Took another 5 years for 2009 for us to get 14 meg. But 14 meg not just cabled up to our house, 14 meg in our pocket. 3G was dominant and we were doing 14 meg in our pocket. 2013, this happens. The one on the right, believe it or not, that was yesterday on my Nokia Lumia. I didn't know 4G did that, but apparently it does. So we're doing 100 meg. The one on the left is actually my house. I've got NBN. Hopefully I'll still have NBN soon. apparently I'm going to get a gig as well by the end of the year. So I'm doing 100 meg at home and I'm a regular citizen of this country. So we're doing this kind of speed in 2013. Phenomenally faster than the year before. Stuff moves at a rapid rate. Not only does the technology move at a rapid rate, but so do product releases. You heard earlier, Windows Server 2012 R2, took 1 year to come out. Windows System Center 2012 R2, 1 year to come out. Windows 8.1, 1 year to come out. These used to be 3 year release cycles. Now it's happening year on year. You remember events like PDC? How often did PDC happen? Dude who's been here for 20 years, do you remember? Every 4 years there was a PDC, because every 4 years we had a major announcement, a major Windows release. How often is build? Every year. Stuff is coming fast and so is adoption. Did you know Office Worldwide gets one subscription a second? One subscription a second, that's a 500% growth. Azure's grown at 150%. 85% of the Fortune 500, they use SharePoint and Yammer. And that's gonna maintain, you know why? Because it's all cloud-based. And Kevin Turner remarked actually at the Worldwide Partner Conference recently. He said the last 12, I'll do my Kevin Turner, no, I won't do that. The last 12 months are the biggest launch period in Microsoft history. But guess what? The next 12 months are the biggest launch period in Microsoft history. Stuff is coming fast, we love it, but today is about learning to deal with it. So there are two constants. That technology is going to continue to accelerate in speed and in pace, but there's one thing that's going to change, that has to change, and that you now have to operate at the speed of that technology or faster than it. You have to deploy, you have to build faster than the technology is coming out, lest you become obsolete. And that's what this next three, four days are about for you guys. It's learning everything that you're going to learn, but it's going back and using it. Because you wait a year, that's a blink. You wait a year now before you go to next year's tech ed, before you learn what you deployed, deploy what you learned at last year's tech ed, you're going to miss out. You're going to lose out. A really good example of this is this guy. Remember when the first Kinect for Xbox 360 came out? It's like 2 years ago-ish. 2 years later, this is about to come out. Yes, I know, we have one over there. This is about to come out. The amount of innovation that's happened in those last 2 years is impressive, and you're going to see some of that in a second, but it's not that that's impressive. It's the fact that we released it before it became obsolete, and we released it before someone else did. So our ability, as Microsoft's ability to deploy and do things as quickly as the technology comes out, is just as important as the technology itself, and that rule applies to everyone. Now, do we want to have a look at the new Kinect? All right, that's weak, but all right, I'll take it, because you're going to look at it anyway. All right, to help me play with the new Kinect for Xbox One, please welcome from the Xbox division, Mark Pakula. Hey, Mark. How are you? Good, man, how are you? Awesome. All right, we're going to have a play with the Xbox, the Kinect for Xbox One.
Yeah,
that's what it's called.
Sarah just bumped it a little bit.
Someone bumped into it, that's all right. So the reason we're showing you this is because it's the amount of innovation that's happened in that short period of time. In the last 2 years, this is what's happened, and it's coming to market soon. It's coming to market in the Xbox console in November.
That's right.
So what are we looking at, Mark?
Cool, so this is the depth camera that Kinect sees by default. You can see there's a lot of detail here. If you've ever seen the 360 version, you had to stand sort of 2 or 3 meters away. Now Michael can be around 1 meter just over, and it can still fit him. You can see the detail in his shirt, creasing, buttons, even make out his face with that, which is pretty amazing. A lot of data to work with there. Cool, so this is the 1080p wide-angle field of view camera that's built into the Kinect. Awesome for Skype on your lounge. It just looks super clear, super sharp. You know, it's not a brightly lit room here, and it's still coming up nice and clear, which is awesome. So here's a brand new mode for Kinect, and it's called Active IR. It works in low light or no light. I'm just going to shine the torch on Michael here so you can see the difference. So in the RGB camera in the bottom corner there, you can see that light. But on the Active IR, it's not affected by visible light at all.
So this is what happens when you're playing Xbox and your Kinect is on and the sun comes up and
exactly.
Everything just goes nuts.
Yep, won't be an issue at
that,
all.
So that no longer happens, right? Because
exactly right.
We're compensating with the eye. But I love that, that there's no difference, right? And that is the amount of compute power that's on that that's
exactly
compensating,
right? Exactly
all right.
Right. So let's take a look at the brains of Kinect. So this guy's a little bit familiar. We call him Stickman. With the new Kinect, there's a lot more joints, a lot more flexibility.
So there used to be like 16 joints?
Yeah, around that. Now around there's that? A lot more.
Okay. How many is there now? Oh, can we get back? The best gesture ever. So it does fingers, right?
Yeah.
So you can see, you want to see the best gesture ever? You ready? The devil horns. Look at that. He picks them up. How good. He won't let me do the other one, just for the record.
No.
All right.
Cool.
What's this guy?
This guy's Blockman. So this is for tracking rotation of limbs. So for instance, if you're playing a tennis game, you can actually measure and put spin on the ball with real accuracy.
Does that track my head as well?
Yep.
Awesome.
Really cool. Another new mode is muscle and force. So it's measuring his weight distribution there. And if he does a few little punches, you'll see how it picks up those.
So that picks up, oh,
big
wow.
Punch there, yep.
Oh, you know what it does? Oh, my God. Reality. Hadouken! Oh, totally. Yes!
Don't knock me out.
Cool. I can retire. We're done.
No. So this is a bit of a freaky mode for Kinect, but Kinect can actually see your heart rate. So it measures the blood flow just
beneath
your
skin.
Up? Let's bring it up. Let's see what happens.
In
see
fact,
how fit you are.
Is that tracking my head?
It is.
Can I lose it?
Let's see. It tracks at 30 frames a second, so it's pretty unlikely to lose your face. But you can see the pulse is getting closer, and occasionally it does come up with an actual figure on that.
So my heart really going
cool.
up now.
So let's track the face again, and we'll do some expressions. So give us a nice smile, Mike.
How you
beautiful.
Doing?
You can see the character in the bottom. Picks that up. You can see whether he's talking, his mouth's open, eyes, glasses, all of that detail. So amazing technology built into the new Kinect.
Does it do it? No.
No.
Oh, it did. No, it didn't. All cool. right. That's a bit of preview of what's happening with Kinect. Can we thank Mark, please?
Thanks, guys.
What's cool about this is you're seeing stuff that's happened just in the last 12 months, the last 2 years. This has been released. And it came to market just as quick. Another thing I want to talk about is imaging, something that's changed dramatically over the last 20 years. Remember what it used to be like to take images and put them on a screen? Now, We can put 41 million of them in our pocket, maybe? So to talk about some of the big advancements that have happened in imaging over the last 20 years and what's happening with that technology, please welcome from Nokia? I think so. Please welcome from Nokia, Vaughn Knight.
Thanks, Michael. So a lot's happened since 1994. Let's talk about navigation. So in 1994, you would have been using a street directory or a paper map, and you would have been drawing on it with a pen. Guidance would have been asking your friends where to go, or possibly talking to a guy at a petrol station. 2004, you would have been searching online. You would have looked at line-by-line navigations, you would have had a map, and if you missed that turn, you were lost. 2009, you didn't get lost anymore. Navigation was in your pocket. Maps had gone mobile. But in 2013, with the Here Navigation Suite on Nokia Lumia devices, you have 196 countries, 47 million kilometres of road, and you also have 85 million places. Not only that, you can download that data to your device and have it available offline. But it's not just having all that data that creates this acceleration in technology. It's innovating on top of that data. So whether it's voice-guided navigation with Here Drive in multiple languages available offline, or whether you're looking at augmented reality when you couple a Here City Lens with the other sensors on the phone, such as the gyroscope, the compass, and the camera. So let's talk about the camera. Photography in 1994, you would have been using a film camera. I'm going to take about 1,000 photos this week. For 1,000 photos, you would have used 30 rolls of film. And I wouldn't have seen any of those photos until next week when I got them developed. If you did have a digital camera, you had a Kodak DC20. The DC20 took photos at a whopping 0.2 megapixels. Not only that, if you printed it off, you could blow it up to the size of a postage stamp. In 2004, we had mobile phones doing 1.3 megapixel photos. 2009, you were taking 5 megapixel photos, and not only that, you were now recording video on your phone. But in 2013, with 41 megapixel sensors in devices such as the Nokia Lumia 1020, you're taking photos with fidelity and quality never possible before on a mobile phone. But the acceleration in technology is not just because there are more pixels. It's because people are innovating on top of those 41 million pixels. With Nokia ProCam and Nokia SmartCam, you're able to take action shots, remove objects from the photo, change faces in the photo. And you have more control over your photography on your mobile phone than ever before. So let me show you an example. So here's a photo that I've taken in the camera roll at the football. And it's a moment that I was lucky to catch. It's a good shot. But the problem with the photo is I now can't really remember what else was happening that day. But what I can do, because of the innovation on top of the camera, is I can see what else was there. And I can zoom out from that photo, and you know what? That's the photo I wish I took. And I can save that to the camera. But it's not only Nokia and Microsoft that are innovating on top of the technology. Let me show you a local app developed that's called Project Tripod. Now, Project Tripod replaces a physical tripod. It's a way for you to align photos without actually needing that physical tripod. So these photos down the bottom were taken on different days by different people on different devices. And so if we go in and have a look at the image alignment, you'll see it's quite impressive. Now, the guys at Project Tripod didn't just go, you know what? That's it. They decided that on top of that, they were going to innovate on their own platform. So they've created the means to go in, pick two photos as one example, and blend those photos together. So what I can do here is I can start blending those photos, and you know what? I'm going to make Sydney sunny, and I'm going to make it rain on North Sydney. Excellent. That'll teach them. So that's Project Tripod. Now, so Project Chopper is built on Windows Phone 8 with all the goodness that that brings and all the tools that that brings to make it easy to develop on. It's using the Nokia Imaging SDK, which allowed them to do things that were not possible for themselves to work with such massive images. It's also built on top of Azure. It's using blobs, using storage, using compute, it's using access control, tables, queues, a lot of things. But the most amazing thing that you should know about this is the story behind it. Now, Jordan had this great idea. And on with that great idea, he went and went to got BizSpark, and he got access to MSDN and all the goodness that brings. And then he went to App Campus, and they secured $70,000 in funding. But the key takeaway from all of this is the conversation that I had with him when he said, I've got a good idea, was 2 months ago. All of that has happened in 2 months. Technology is moving at such a rapid rate, and Project Tripod are a team that can move at the speed of technology. 25 years, or the last 20 years of tech ed, people have been using tripods. And in 2 years, will everyone be using tripods? If you want to know more about the project and sign up to the beta, you should go to projecttripod.com. And if you see the guys in Project Tripod shirts walking around, go up to them. They're happy to show you how it all works. And with that, I'm going to hand you back to Michael.
Oh my God, is that... That is Windows 95. Who remembers that? You do.
I do.
Congratulations. Shiny sticker. All right. Next thing. What has happened over the last 20 years? The cloud has happened quicker than 20 years. So, who remembers deploying like this? Oh yeah. I remember this so well. Do you know how many disks it took to install Office back then, by the way? 39 disks. Do you know why I know this fact? Because of disk number 28. That is why I know this fact. I remember it so well. I'm there, and then all of a sudden, disk number 38 comes in, and you know what it's saying? And I'm stuck. So how long did it take to deploy Office in 1994? I don't know. 39 disks times a pain in the ass number. Took hours to deploy Office, hours to deploy the PC. It took forever to do things back then, right? And servers, where were servers? Servers? They were sitting under your desk. Fast forward 10 years, and that server has moved to the corner of the office that has air conditioning next to it. And we were deploying stuff on our PCs, not installing them with floppy. We'd upgraded to Ghost. We were building images and imaging machines at a time. So we went from a deployment of one machine in half a day to, 2 hours maybe, right? So we accelerated in those 10 years, kind of, sort of, I reckon. 2009, massive things happened, right? You all started to put your machines in a data center. You started to use a data center. You were no longer fiddling around with RAM and SCSI and all that stuff. You were moving yourself up the OSI model. You're doing stuff far more important than making sure your RAM wasn't overheating, as mine seems to frequently. 2009, the data center ascended into the cloud, is what happened. 2009, you can deploy servers, as you saw earlier-ish, with a failed demo. He speaks before his fails. And now you could deploy as many servers as you want with a bunch of clicks in Azure. Scott Guthrie is going to be here for the lock note, and he's going to talk a lot about Azure. Since we're going back to 2004, I figured it's only appropriate to do that. Can anyone guess whose hair that is, by the way? Jeffers. Jeffers' hair. That is Joe Dirt, for anyone who remembers that movie. All right, so Azure is growing at a rapid rate as well. Half the Fortune 500 companies use Azure. It's growing at 150%. Everyone I seem to meet at this tech ed seems to already be using Azure. What's interesting about Azure is their release cycles, the way they keep up with the technology is by defining it, their release cycles are monthly. New features get rolled out to Azure every month. Every 6 months, major features get rolled out. Azure is operating at this new speed. One of my favorite examples of this locally is MYOB. Who knows Account Right Live? That's that purple box at this dude. Yes. It's the purple, is it still Officeworks? Yeah, at the Officeworks, you get the Account Right Live, right? MYOB wanted to take a desktop app, one of the hardest things I can think of to turn into a cloud app. They wanted to take a desktop app and put it into the cloud. And they've done that with Azure. So now every time someone fires off a new installation of Account Right Live, using the sync framework, a new instance gets created on SQL Azure, and it synchronizes between the two. The reason I'm telling you this is they did that in a matter of months. They took what seems to be the most complex thing to put in the cloud, a desktop PC app. In a matter of months, they're coming to the cloud. Scott will be here in the lock note to talk a whole bunch more about the stuff happening with Azure. In fact, the Azure team has been pretty cool. They're actually giving you the chance to win Surface Pro. So activate your MSDN subscriptions, your Azure inside your MSDN subscriptions, or sign up for a free trial and you go in the running. All the details are there, and you can learn more in the showcase area. Another major product that's gone through this transformation, another major product that now operates at the speed of cloud, is Office. You know, it used to be that Office had engineering milestones that were 3 years apart. They'd set a date 3 years from now, and they would say, 3 years from now, this is what we're going to put in market. Let's go. And every engineer focuses on that one release date. And they, hopefully, 3 years from now, that's still relevant. That's not what happens now. Office releases monthly now. That's a massive, I can't think of a more complex, bigger product to build and support than Office. They now release monthly, not 3 years. Because if Office blinks, they'll miss it. There'll be another kid somewhere building an equivalent. Not really, but anyway. So Office now ships at a regular pace. They are keeping up with the speed of technology as well. And to talk about what Office is doing and the outcomes of that great engineering, please welcome the Director of Product Management for the Microsoft Office Division, the other Michael, Michael Atala.
He's going the distance. He's going for speed.
It's a privilege to be back here, folks. This is my second year coming to TechEd here in Australia. As I noticed this 20-year anniversary, as I was preparing for this, I started thinking back to where I was 20 years ago. It was the beginning of my tech career. It was actually the first TechEd I attended in North America was 1994. I remember spending most of my time in cold data centers resetting passwords for users that didn't remember if they'd capitalized the P or not. Some things never change, I suppose. I remember the JDP or RDP for Exchange Server, depending on which one you remember being part of, and all the note servers and GroupWise servers that bit the dust after Exchange Server came on market that next year. So fast forward 20 years to 2 weeks ago. So a little bit of a personal story. 2 weeks ago, I found myself running a race in the Pacific Northwest United States called the Hood to Coast. It's a 320-kilometer race, relay race, the team of people, whereby each runner in the race is challenged with running three legs of a race as part of a contiguous race throughout the night from Mount Hood in Oregon to the Pacific coastline, our side of the Pacific coast line. It's an interesting challenge because you're running on minimal rest, you're getting back up, you're not getting a shower, and you need one badly. And it taught me something about personal growth and challenges. It taught me that it wasn't just about reaching the finish line. It was about reaching the finish line, standing up, and running again. The analogy to tech is unavoidable for me because we've all taken on a challenge in this room over the past 20 years of incorporating changing technology into our infrastructure, into our businesses, into our applications. And we've succeeded. We've finished. And then we find ourselves preparing for that next innovation that changes our lives or our work or the world around us. Being ready to run again is what separates those that were here 20 years ago, that one gentleman right over there, and those that are still here today, so congratulations. One of the most enduring images of this year for me is this one. This is a photograph taken at the papal convocation of Pope Francis in Rome earlier this year. Because I think it's a reflection of how this wave of tech innovation sort of instantiates itself in what we're living every day. It's pretty dramatic. It shows how deeply into society and culture tech has penetrated, particularly when juxtaposed against this photo, which was taken 8 years previous at the papal convocation of Pope Benedict. It's fascinating, the difference. 8 years, not that long. But there is one guy in this photo who was the true visionary. Is he here today? Are you here today? No? Okay. In the business world, this societal change couples with the realities of the workforce we're all dealing with every day. Workforce that contains members of the typewriter generation, the smartphone generation, and the one in between, which I'm actually, I think, officially part of. If we brought the lights up in the room today, we'd see all three of those generations represented in this room. And for all of us, this change in the industry and the world around us represents new challenges, a reason to run again, if you will. And at Microsoft, it's the motivating force for our transformation into a devices and services company. So, devices and services. Those of you that read the news of the day would have seen that phrase thrown around a little bit. What's it all about? What does it mean to you for Microsoft to become a devices and services company? How will it change the way you work, the way you grow professionally, the way you run your businesses? While I can't pretend to know exactly how it has affected each of you in this room and how it will, I can tell you how Office has absorbed this change and illustrate how the opportunities and challenges that it creates for all of us. So for Office, the last 20 years have meant evolving and transforming as the way all of us work has changed. Initially a set of discrete tools meant for specialized workers, Office has evolved to be the most complete productivity solution on the planet, supporting the work of over a billion people every day. And today, Office must accommodate an increasingly global economy, just like all of us do every day, an array of devices that is rapidly evolving, and physical distribution of workers that went from office to home to a chair on the beach. Much of the appeal of Office through those years has been the popularity of its rich capabilities. And delivering those capabilities is a large part of a lot of people in this room's job every day, and accountability to the users that the IT folks in the room support. Historically, a new version of Office meant deployment. It's a pretty nasty word a lot of times in IT. It's a dreaded moment. It brings back memories of late nights, stress, sleepless evenings. Can we play the video that I have really quick? So what I'm showing you right now is, I'm sure, the most boring video ever played at a tech ed keynote, and it is fabulous how boring it is. This is a reflection of Microsoft's transformation into devices and services, and Office specifically. I shot this video on a trip to Tokyo earlier this year. I was alerted of an update on my laptop that Office was being to be updated via the Office 365 subscription service. I got the update while I was traveling on the Narita Express, a bullet train that goes from Narita Airport to Tokyo. I was connected via 3G hotspot I'd rented at the airport just a little bit before. You're watching Office in a devices and services world. This is modern deployment. This is distribution of Office via service using application virtualization. Now, from an engineering perspective, this required massive change. Smaller, more frequent updates meant building Office differently. We had crossed the finish line on deployment. We were done. But it was time to get up and run again. Now, we couldn't ship all of Office every time, so we had to componentize differently, more granularly, so that we could update the product more granularly, more frequently. We couldn't rely on application virtualization being there. We had tried that. We had to build it in. We couldn't lower the quality bar that you had all come to expect from us, so we had to build a new dev rhythm. We used to run 28-week engineering milestones multiple times in a ship cycle to the 3-year deliverable of Office, and we moved that to 1-month sprints. And we had to rethink incremental delivery of features within those 1-month sprints, as opposed to packaging them up over a 3-year period and shipping them. We had to accommodate the demands of the folks in this room around systems management. We had to be able to enable you to use tools like System Center and Tivoli to deploy office. And so we created application virtualization packages that you could then proxy to your users instead of relying on the 365 service itself. We had to think about small update packages with low bandwidth and minimal disruption in mind. We used to have a whole milestone, a whole 28-week milestone set aside to do backwards compatibility and regression testing. Now we have to do that every month in every sprint because every month is RTM. Think about that. Office RTMs every month. The result of all these investments has benefited us greatly, a more agile engineering team. We're able to deliver updates more rapidly, smaller. For you, major deployment is now an update problem. Less headaches and hopefully more sleep. Now, the modern workplace that we all are used to working in contains a plethora of devices and environments, and more, workers are moving between those environments frequently. So expectations of universal access, as defined by the myriad of internet services out there, must be met by every new application and every service, and Office is no exception. 10 years ago, do I have this up on the screen? 10 years ago, we shipped OneNote. Here it is on my Lumia, Nokia, Microsoft Lumia phone. This is part of the transformation from paper to digital for Microsoft a decade ago, and it's still everything that it always promised to be. Here's a list of things that I needed to keep track of as I was packing for my trip here. I'll check a few things that I know I brought. I did not bring any dresses, but I did bring some dressy outfits. Now, as an avid user of OneNote, I have come to expect a rich experience on this device right here. But it really isn't about the app. It's about the information. And I need to know that I can go to any device, anywhere, and open OneNote and have access to that same information. And in a second or two, you'll see the update from the changes I just made from the phone. Now, picking up right where I left off, what's important about this isn't the app. You all know what OneNote is. What's important about this is that the cloud was not an afterthought. It wasn't a thing off to the side. I didn't have to go to the cloud and put my data there. The cloud is simply part of the fabric of Office. That's what devices and services means to the way we built OneNote. And whether it's part of how it's deployed or what its capabilities are, the cloud is always there. Now, fundamental to the shift that we've made with Office also is about providing an app dev model that allows folks in this room to extend the power of Office using rich cloud services, so that you can bring your specific knowledge into the Office experience directly. On this surface right here, I'm actually running an app that I know I live in quite a lot, and I'm sure many of you do as well, Outlook. And right here in this email, you actually see here the manifestation of that app dev model, at least an example of it. The Bing team at Microsoft was one of the first internally to see the opportunity that presented itself by the new application development model in Office. An opportunity for them to bring its services closer to the user in context of a specific Office experience. In this case, somebody reading an email, which happens to have an address in it. In this case, the Bing Maps app for Office identifies that address, you can see it hit highlighted below, and gives me a map. This isn't a snapshot. This isn't an image of a map. This is a live, interactive preview of that location. That sandbox environment is connected directly to web services. Now, again, what a tremendous untapped opportunity for the folks in this room, for the collective creativity and brain power of all the developers in here. Apps that do predictive analysis, apps that help me decide what is important, apps that help me find real-time information about or people who email me outside of the org data that I already have, tracking information for packages I've gotten emails on, CRM information about customers that have emailed me. Go build these apps. The list goes on. And this is just Outlook, the same application development model in Word, Excel, PowerPoint, SharePoint, on both the rich apps and the desktops, is a huge opportunity for the developers here. Now, in the world of new and exciting devices, this gigantic display behind me is one of the more awesome. this perceptive pixel screen, 82-inch capacitive touch screen with 100 points of touch. It's a gigantic smartphone, if you will. It's very cool. It's fun to play with. We'll have some down in the booth later. I suggest you come by and check it out. Now, with a device as beautiful as this, what Office app would you expect me to show you? Excel, of course, right? Yeah, Excel. Yeah. Let's go to Excel, because nothing's better than a gigantic spreadsheet. So Excel has always been one of the most powerful analytical tools on the market and has become extremely powerful in the last few releases. It's becoming an even more powerful BI tool, particularly when SQL and SharePoint get to participate in the ecosystem with it. There's a soon-to-be-released add-in that some of you may have seen that's in preview right now called PowerMap. PowerMap is a 3D visualization tool for Excel that provides an immersive experience for making discoveries in data in three dimensions that wouldn't be easy to, or obvious to identify in a traditional two-dimensional table like this. It lets you plot geographic and temporal data visually and analyze it in three dimensions, and then create something like a cinematic tour or a movie of that data. It's a great way to visualize data brought into Excel through Power Query or Power Pivot. So this workbook is an example of, let's say, some data that we're thinking of expanding our business out of Australia into the European market. So we're starting to try to identify, as a group, all 3,000 of us, which country we think is best to expand in first. So we've got things like per capita income here, mobile, internet subscriptions, download speeds. Let's take a look at what this looks like if we visualize it with PowerMap. So I'm going to just, there we go. There we go. Come on. Is Jeff Woolsey in the room? Jeff Woolsey, did you pray to the demo gods after your demo crashed this morning? No? Okay. No, he didn't, obviously. Okay. This is me kneeling to the demo gods and picking up my mouse. Let's see if I can find it. Oh. It's even worse. There it is. Yeah. All right. I might have to go back down and kneel again, guys. I apologize. So what you're looking at, let's find out. No. All right. We're going to use a mouse. That's all right. So what you're looking at is the average annual income, the mobile subscription data, internet statistics around European markets. And you can see already, this is super awkward, guys. You can see already that I can modify this data, and gosh, it would be beautiful if I was using this great touchscreen. But that's all right. You can see that here I'm looking at data about annual income. Here I'm looking at data about mobile subscriptions. And in this last window right here, I'm looking at some basic internet statistics. Come on, there we go. So we're looking at basically internet subscribers in the markets in Europe. So I'm going to add a little more data to this because it doesn't totally have enough for me. So I'm going to add another layer to this scene in my movie, in my cinematic movie. This is really hard to do. Okay, so I'm going to add city data. I want to get some geocoding data. And in this case, I'm getting it from Bing Maps directly. I'm going to map that. So you're going to see the geocoding data get added to the map already. Now I'm going to go ahead and add download speed so I get a sense for within internet subscribers what the download speeds look like. And I'm going to do that right here. Whoa. Cool. And then I'm going to change the chart type to make it a little easier to compare to a heat map. Come on. So close. Yeah. All right. Now, let's take a look at what it looks like to present this data, because what we've learned is while Austria in the first two categories are really great business opportunities, it looks like internet subscribers and broadband is not super sweet in Austria, so maybe it's not our best chance. So let's present that data in a cinematic tour. So yeah, average income per person, looks like Austria is a good choice right here. High income per capita income. Austria's in second place on mobile cellular subscription. That seems like a great choice of regions to go after. But then we start looking at internet subscriber speeds. Wow, yeah, Austria looks like internet subscribers are hot everywhere else, but even Denmark in a much smaller country is killing them in the size of the market. So maybe not the best market. That's extending the capabilities of a powerful desktop app. That's an app that's running in a virtualized environment, that's deployed via a web service, that's connected to public web services, that's displayed on a huge capacitive multi-touch display. That's modern productivity. That's what devices and services is about. That's the journey Office has been on. And there's no end to the journey. We must all, every day, strive to meet the challenge that constant change presents. The people, products, and organizations that have succeeded in this challenge have the endurance to stand up and run again. TechEd is all about exploring what we've accomplished so far and what we can go achieve next. I'm excited to spend the next few days exploring with you, so thank you and have a great TechEd. Well, that sucked. Why are you not working, friend? All right. So, we talked about that internet speed that was building up over those last 20 years. What did we do with that internet speed? This is what we did with that internet speed. We built stuff on it. 1994, this, who remembers this? 20-year-old dude does. You do. This was the original Microsoft website. I think it had, what was the nickname, Frank? It was called the Death Star. So this was the original Microsoft website. This was Microsoft.com in 1994. Running NT351. Guess how many hits a day? 124,000 hits a day. Mega. It was running on three servers. And at this point in time, the building for the web, putting stuff on the web, was the realm of the big tech companies and the nerds. Fast forward, just 10 years, and now everyone's on the web. Everyone's on the web. You don't operate in 2004 unless you have a web presence at a bare minimum. And for most companies, the web became integral to their business. So the web became first class and new businesses were born. Doesn't seem that long ago, but you know what happened in 2004? Facebook happened in 2004. So fast forward to 2009, and the best website is the one that's in your pocket. Mobile started to take over, and the mobile web became huge. And then apps started to appear. And people started building apps, and there were some success stories. But now, just like the web, it took 10 years for the web to be core to every business. It has taken 5 years for apps to be core. Most important business conversations are happening around apps. I want to talk about two apps that I love. One of them is car sales. In fact, I'll show you a preview of a car sales app. So car sales is on Windows 8. I don't know if you've seen it, but I'd encourage you to go and have a download and a play with it. But car sales is on Windows 8. I want to show you a preview of the phone app. So this is the phone app. And it looks something like this. You launch the app using the modern Windows design. So we're going to search for cars. And what are we going to look for? We are going to look for something without an internet connection. Oh, no, internet, come back to me. No, we're not. There it is. Thank you. All right, so we're going to search for more options. We're going to find a car in the year. What year should we go to? 94. No, good choice. How did you come up with that all by yourself? All right. Heaps of training. Leave the comedy to the professionals, sir. All right. So, these are cars from 2004. Oh, my God. How is that getting? He's not going to get $8,000 for that. Is he? Oh, look at that guy. All right. We're going to pin this to our start screen. And now we can access that car anytime we want to access it. Or we can go back into the app and look at our previous searches. What I'm showing you is a modern Windows 8, Windows Phone style app. This very much resembles the Windows 8 style app. If you haven't used the Windows 8 style app, I highly recommend you have a play with it just to get a good example for what a modern Windows 8 app looks like. In fact, I love the Windows 8 app so much, I gave it a 5 in the store. So, car sales. Why am I showing you car sales? How long do you think that app took to build, the Windows 8 app?
8 weeks. It took 8 weeks to build a Windows 8 app. It took 5 weeks to build the Windows Phone app. That is moving at a rapid pace. That is taking the tools, and actually Car Sales was here last year, and they learnt the tools and they built the app in a matter of 8 weeks. Stuff happens at a rapid rate and people are building at the same speed. Another app I want to talk about that I personally love a lot because I'm a gamer. Gamers? Yeah, I don't even have to ask, you're all gamers. So, I'm a gamer. And Dimitri and the Giant Machine guys had this like vision, right? Dimitri's been building games for like 15 years. And he had this vision. He didn't want to build a game for anyone. He wanted to build a game for everyone. And there's a primary difference. He doesn't want a game that just works, that anybody could just use. He wanted a game that tailored to every audience. And what that meant, and the reason why he chose to put his app on Windows, was he got to choose the platform.
Just walk away.
He got to choose how the game was played.
Round one.
Because Windows gives you choice. So this is Last Gun on a Windows phone. Very simple controls, accelerometer, gameplay lasts like a minute at most, and you can play solo on a bus. Kind of cool, right? Pretty much my favorite game on Windows. But this is the same game, because real gamers use mice. So this is the same game, the Windows 8 version of the game, on a PC. And here I am playing with a mouse and a keyboard, giving me, and a touchscreen. So I'm WASD, the way games are meant to be played. And I've got my crosshair moving with my mouse, and I've got the precision that I need. So that's another category in the everyone spectrum. The next style of play is touch. Dimitri wanted to play not on a little tablet. Dimitri wanted to play on a big screen. So this is a Sony Tap 20. And now you can do social gaming, true social gaming, where you can play one across from the other, and you can use touch to control your player. Same game, by the way, same code base. This is just the Windows 8 version of the game. I'm on the left, by the way, with the big furry fingers. And on the right is Sarah from our office. I'm not proud of what happens next. That happens next. But that's okay, you know why? Because I'm a real gamer, and real gamers use controllers. So we're in Windows land, remember? You get to make a game that uses a controller because it's just a PC after all. So this one game runs across every possible scenario you can think of. It's not one game that anyone can play. It's a game that everyone can play. And I know what you're thinking, let's not look again. And I actually tried that second time as well, by the way. It's a game that you can play on any device. And I know what you're thinking, we've got these Perceptive Pixels back here. Turns out you too can play it on a Perceptive Pixels. So that's us on the big screen. Dimitri's on the right, by the way. That's us on the big screen, playing the same game, the same code base. We rocked up here the other day, yesterday, and saw that and went, why don't we play it on that? The same code base across everything. So why am I telling you this? By the way, that was all filmed on the Lumia 1020, by the way. How good was that resolution, right? That image, that's 1080 video, filmed on the 1020. Last Gun's $149 in the store if you guys want to buy it, both the Windows 8 and the Windows Phone store. Highly recommend you have a play. If you find me, I want a rematch with Sarah and anyone who wants to challenge me on that. I've been playing it for a year now. That is an app I love. I loved it so much, I rated that one too. So why am I telling you the story of Dimitri? Well, Dimitri's been doing this for 15 years. The dude's built dozens of games in those 15 years. Do you know the little secret about Rovio, for example? Rovio is the company that builds Angry Birds. That overnight success, Angry Birds. That 35 games before Angry Birds. Halfbrick, who build? Fruit Ninja, Jetpack Joyride is the game, really, right? Fruit Ninja and Jetpack Joyride. That's 16 games before those games, and they've been around for 2002. So it turns out good developers get practice. It turns out being really good at this stuff and building the next big thing takes a lot of practice. I've always loved this quote. Opportunity is missed by most people because it's dressed in overalls and looks a lot like work. It turns out that to be good at anything, including building apps, you need a lot of practice. We ran this thing a little while ago. This was a winter of apps, we called it, where we gave away a bunch of stuff for people who wanted to build apps. This is Brighton. This is one of the devs. We've had emails from like 10 of the devs who were part of it and said, thank you for giving me the opportunity and the excuse to build a bunch of apps. Because now I've got my muscle on. I've got my, that's his version of exercise. So we're doing it again. We're announcing a competition right now where we're going to give away Lumia 925s, a bunch of Xbox 360s, Lumia 520s. If you want to build some apps and get your exercise on, build those 35 apps before you build your 36th app. We've got some incentives, so if you guys want to go there and have a look and learn more about this. Please go there. We'd love to see some of the apps that you guys end up building. There's a special offer happening at TechEd, and that is this. Every delegate, you can applaud it if you'd like, but you wouldn't. So you were expecting a free one, weren't you? You tight asses. Yeah. So $299 gets you a Windows, a Surface RT 64 with a touch cover. And that's available to each of you, only attendees at TechEd and one per attendee. You want to learn more about it in the showcase area, you'll learn more. Don't look so disappointed. Thank you, happiness. So on to our last speaker. When it takes 8 weeks to build a Windows 8 app, when it takes 5 weeks to build a Windows Phone app, this is fast. This is adapting to the speed of technology as it happens. What's interesting about success is that it also comes with failures. And being able to do stuff quickly is just as important. Now, Adam Pasoni, who's the CTO of Yammer, I met with him a few weeks ago, and he blew my mind talking about the way Yammer operates and the way you have to operate to live in a very highly disruptive world. So if you think about what it means when you're, forget building apps, forget deploying servers in a comfy, cushy job with a paycheck. You build something on the web, and there's a kid in like a garage in his parents' house building the same thing. It's not the technology that's the only thing to watch out for and to outpace. It is everyone else who's building the same features as you are. So thinking about how to constantly keep on top of that and to keep up with the speed of not only the technology but your competition and thinking about disruption, please welcome the CTO of Yammer, Adam Pasoni.
Good to be here. It's my first TechEd. It's actually my first time in Australia as well. Just looking at all of the incredible technology that's coming, it is so exciting to see how rapidly it's changing. It's also a bit terrifying though, isn't it? I mean, how do you take advantage of it all? How can you possibly keep up? That's what I want to talk a little bit about today. How the biggest problem we face actually isn't technology preventing us from taking advantage of these things. It's how we work. How many people here remember Tower Records? Anybody? No? That's a couple. Tower Records was a music store that started in 1960, was extremely successful. They expanded across the US, eventually internationally. They had a meteoric rise for 40 years until they peaked in 1999 with sales of over $1 billion. That exact same year, we saw the rise of another music service, Napster. It's now gone today. After 40 years of rise, Tower Records filed for bankruptcy a mere 5 years later. 5 years after 40 years of success. And ironically, the same service that helped disrupt them itself got disrupted by other services like Ardio and Spotify. There are so many stories of companies getting disrupted because they failed to keep up. They failed to take advantage of the rapid increase in change in technology. In fact, only 50% of the companies that were in the Fortune 500 in 1995 are still there today. So why is the pace of change accelerating? Let's just answer this question first. Well, at a super basic level, when people connect, when they learn new information, it changes their behavior and their ideas and their expectations. And so what we've seen in the past several decades is that we have gotten better and better at connecting people. Technology has flattened the world, and that has what has increased the pace of disruption. Like, imagine go back thousands of years to distant tribes in the Serengeti, how long it would take news of the wheel or fire to make it between tribes, but how disruptive that would have been to them. And now we deal with that type of disruption seemingly on a daily basis. And of course, the problem is, or sort of answering the question, we understand that the pace of change is increasing, but why does that have to lead to disruption? Why are people having such a difficult time accepting all of this technology, dealing with this pace of change? Well, it's because we didn't really build companies to change. Most of you don't work at a company that was built for rapid change. We built companies to be stable and efficient. See, people think that the shape of the modern company, when we think about org charts and your rules and processes, they feel like that was somehow discovered like gravity. Of course it would be this way. But The shape of the modern company was invented, and it was invented at a particular time to solve a particular set of problems we had at that time. It was the Industrial Revolution. And we design companies based on a set of beliefs we don't even agree with anymore. I'm not making this up, but if you look at the early writings of when we had figured out things like structure, process, org charts, we said things like, there's only one right way to do anything, and employees are too dim to figure out what it is. Therefore, we need managers to tell them what to do. We certainly can't empower them. And because we were going to be doing the same thing for dozens of years, it didn't make sense to build adaptability into our companies. It didn't make sense to empower employees in any way. But as we're finding today, change is coming too quickly. All of us are trying to figure out how do we use this technology to advance our careers, to help our company. We built companies for a time when work was routine, when you could tell people exactly what to do, when your job would have been the same thing every day. Well, it's no wonder it's not working. This Gartner study shows that the amount of non-routine work at work is increasing dramatically just in the last couple of years. Non-routine work is characterized by being self-directed, requiring judgment and creativity. A lot of the work we have here, obviously, that we do is what we'd consider non-routine, but it's getting increasingly non-routine. I bet most people here feel like every day they're facing challenges that they didn't necessarily plan for. It's hard to schedule our own lives now. And employees themselves are feeling this gap between, and probably all of us here are feeling that gap between the way we build companies and the realities they face. We have an epidemic of employee engagement problems where employees are every day faced with challenges that they're ill-equipped and unempowered to handle, which leaves people feeling disillusioned and disengaged. I think this chart, this Deloitte Shift Index, perfectly demonstrates the mix of these trends. The Deloitte Shift Index shows us that even though productivity has been increasing for the last 40 years, return on assets, which is a key measure of performance, has been declining in our biggest companies that entire time. What it shows us is that even though we're trying to get better and better at running our companies, we're actually getting worse and worse. That our companies, the more we try to make them efficient, become worse and worse as the pace of change increases. And at a fundamental level, we think about what we do in companies. We learn information, we respond to that information. Well, in the past, we didn't have to do it that much. We didn't have to learn from our customers. Imagine when product release cycles were 3 years. As Michael said, we'd have some ideas, we'd go away for a while, we'd work on them, we'd come back, hopefully it would work. And it did work for a long time. But disruption at a fundamental level, and this is whether it's a company level or personal level, happens when your customers learn faster than you, when they start iterating faster than you, when they start responding to information faster than you. So you go back to Blockbuster, and you look back at it and say, well, it happened so fast. How could they have stopped that disruption? But there were so many signals. There were so many ways that if they had been open to the changes, they could have heard from their customers and responded in kind. But because they didn't, because they learned so slower than their customers, they got disrupted. And disruption doesn't just happen at the company level. We see this in IT and in plenty of fields. Disruption happens at the team level, at the role level. But it is not all bad news. And here is the key thing I want to leave you with as we talk the rest here. The pace of change is the same for everybody. It is the same for you as it is for the people you work with, as it is for your competitors, which means it's a level playing field, which means you can use the pace of change. You can use this onslaught of technology to your advantage. You can capitalize on those changes to be a person that excels during this time of rapid change. Now, there's a whole bunch of changes companies have to make in order to take advantage of the pace of information and change. And we call those kinds of companies responsive organizations. These are companies that are built to learn and respond rapidly to new information by optimizing for the open flow of information, for experimentation, for rapid iteration, and by creating a network with their employees, customers, and their partners. And what I want to do is first actually give you an example of what I think of as a responsive organization. Zara is a fashion company in Spain. They're known for fast fashion. And if you think about it, fashion is one of those things that falls out of fashion really quickly, much like software does now. People change their expectations constantly. So imagine you were creating a fashion company. You would probably build it like you'd build any other company. You'd build an org chart where you'd have a division for manufacturing, you'd have a division for design, you'd have a division for retail. And just think about how long it would take to get a new product to market. The design department would work on it for a while, wait till it was perfect, hand it off to distribution, and so on. Zara realized that the real impediment to moving quickly wasn't technology, but it was how they worked together. So what they did is they take people from across the whole org, from all those different divisions, and they put them together on a cross-functional team around a single garment. And in this way, they can innovate across organizational boundaries, and they can get a garment from design to the store shelf in 15 days, which is practically miraculous in the industry. Now, if you think what's interesting about that story is that they can get more clothes out faster, it's sort of missing the point. What they've done is they have figured out how to decrease the cost of failure so that they can increase the rate of experimentation. In this way, they can rapidly try new ideas at small scales and invest in the things that are working and not invest in the things that aren't working. They can avoid the trap of Tower Records. They can make sure they're never investing in things that their customers don't care about anymore. So there's a number of shifts that we're seeing companies make, successful companies, and the people in those companies as they transition into responsive organizations. And remember what we talked about, companies weren't built for change, they were built for non-routine work, but we're seeing the amount of non-routine work, increase. Companies, employees every day are faced with new challenges that they don't have the right information to handle. And so they either give up or become disillusioned. The best example of this actually is customer service. We've probably all had that experience of calling a customer service department only to find that they couldn't help us. They didn't have the information. They didn't want to help us. They were themselves were disillusioned. One of our customers is Nationwide. One of their customers was on a vacation and his RV broke down. And he called his local insurance broker who told him he wasn't covered, so he was stuck. So that gentleman called Nationwide. Customer service rep answered. Customer service rep also didn't know whether they were covered. But instead of giving up, instead of just escalating up the org chart, that customer service rep just posted a message in Yammer, in their local network. And within moments, people from across the company, from different parts of the org, from the product group and the claims group, came together to try to figure out if that customer could be helped. And they figured out that customer was covered, and not only that, they figured out how to get emergency funds to that customer so that he could get back on the road quickly. They probably saved that customer. They could have lost it. The key here was that they ignored the org chart. They worked together as a network. When we look at all the changes in our customers, how quickly your customers are changing, it's because they are a network. They're communicating on social media channels. They're communicating in so many different ways. Well, of course, we're going to have to figure out how to be a network ourselves. All the information in the world is in a giant network now. And yet within our companies, we still operate in these silos. But it's possible for people at every level, to reach out and work with other people, ignoring the org chart, working together as a network. Because it takes a network to serve a network. And again, if we look back at what we thought about companies to begin with, how employees were too dim to figure out the right way of doing things, it's no wonder that we have such a disillusioned employee base and it's so hard to get information about what's happening with our customers. So Red Robin is a hamburger chain in the US, a pretty large hamburger chain. And it's funny, they have a lot of problems that sound eerily similar to software companies. They release burgers every once in a while, they change their menu, but it's very scary for them, it's very dangerous for them to change the menu, because if they make a mistake, they can't change it again for a long period of time. It's a lot like releasing software. Who would have thought burgers and software were so similar? So given that it was so dangerous to change the menu every year or two, they were stuck with two options. One, try to make it safer, try to fail less. Do more research, change the menu less frequently. But the other option was to change the menu more frequently, decrease the cost of failure, increase the rate of experimentation. The problem was they didn't have a good way of collecting feedback from their customers, the people eating the burgers. They tried getting feedback on Twitter and Facebook, but it didn't work. But then they realized that real feedback was coming in, but it was coming to the servers that were serving the burgers. Those people that Red Robin had previously called non-knowledge workers. They didn't have email addresses. They weren't on the internet. And so what Red Robin did is they put all of their employees, even the servers, on their Yammer network. And when they tried to release the Tavern Burger, which was this new burger they were working on, they asked them for help. They asked them to give them their opinion, to hear, to give the feedback of what the customers were saying. It used to take them 18 months to release a burger, but they released the Tavern Burger in 4 weeks. In 4 weeks, all because they shortened the gap between their customers. It's interesting, you know, I was talking to this CIO. I actually think it was the CIO of Red Robin. And he made the point that IT often calls the customer, the business side, that's the customer. But that IT has to realize that the customer is the customer. It's the customer of the company. And so one of the challenges is understanding how close do you know your customers? How close, how much feedback do you get? How real time is that feedback? Companies are realizing that the fastest way to learn and respond to new information is when employees are empowered to have a voice and to respond immediately to situations as they arise. This 4-star retired general in the US once said, "The wisest decisions are made by those closest to the problem, regardless of seniority." Another problem that we have in companies is because we knew exactly what every employee was going to do, the way that we motivated them was with traditional carrots and sticks, punishment and reward. And it worked, too. It actually did. That system of motivation works when you know exactly what people are going to do. But that system of motivation doesn't work, the science tells us, when the work requires judgment, when we don't have predictable outcomes we need. And what the science says, and there's a famous writer, Daniel Pink, who talks about in his book Drive, that the thing that motivates employees is actually autonomy, mastery, and purpose in their work when the work is non-routine. Jamba Juice is a big chain of juice stores. Literally, they make, you know, fruit smoothies and stuff. They're half company-owned, half franchise-owned, and they have this challenge of how do they have a consistent customer experience when they have all these quote-unquote non-knowledge workers that work for totally different franchises. Historically, what they tried to do was post posters and notices in the break room that said, do this, be more better, be have better customer service, as if they were going to go back in the break room and read it and say, oh, I need to have better customer service, now I know. So what they did instead is they said, you know what, the only way to really reinforce the right behavior is to motivate people to exhibit the right behavior. So they actually ran a contest where employees could submit nominations for other employees who exhibited their core values. And they ran that contest in Yammer so that it was public, so that everybody in the company could see other employees doing the right things. And the contest went viral. They had hundreds of submissions. And the management was able to respond and say, hey, this is, you know, good job on this. And the rewards were public. In this way, they saw a dramatic change in their behavior because they were motivating them in something that they couldn't prescribe. You can't prescribe good customer service. The final one I want to talk about, and this one I think is sort of near, should be near and dear to everyone here, is that there was a time when information flowed slow. We didn't really need to be close to our customers or our partners. In fact, we viewed those as these separate entities, and we only allowed certain people in our companies to talk to them. But that's increasingly not working when we need information quickly. Westfield is a chain of shopping centers. And even though the retail stores in those shopping centers share a physical space, they don't really have a way of communicating. And so what Westfield did is they created an external network for each shopping center where all of those stores could communicate. And on one occasion, a pipe burst during business hours in one of the shopping centers, stopping everything. Historically, that would have been very difficult for everyone to coordinate on. But because they were all connected as a community, they were able to respond faster and get cleaned up and get back to work and lose a lot less revenue. Westfield realized this last shift, which is, yes, we need to work as a network within our companies, but that network encompasses our customers and our partners. This goes back to that question about how close you are to your customers, internal or external. Now, as you look at these shifts, you might ask yourself what this has to do with you. But here's the deal. all of this technology coming at you and being able to deal with it on a day-to-day basis, capitalize it, go further in your career with it, the problem isn't technological. You know more about technology than other people in your company. The thing that will slow you down most is how your company is organized, is whether you're willing to work outside of your organizational boundaries, whether you're willing to understand your customers and work with people across your company. So you have to ask yourself, are you willing to do that? You have to ask yourself, are there constraints in your company that are preventing people from working together, that are making people compete within the same company? Are you treating your partners and customers the same as your coworkers? And it's not easy. There are so many challenges in this. People think that this means potentially the end of planning. How can you possibly plan when we don't know the future? They think that if you're going to experiment a lot, it means there's no accountability in anything. Well, it does mean we need to be accountable for outcomes and not just deliverables. And it actually means we need more leadership than ever before. Managers tell employees exactly what to do. Leaders give a vision and a direction and then empower people to get there the best way they know how. You know, I think this quote from Jack Welch actually perfectly exemplifies this tension we feel today. It's so hard. There are so many challenges in trying to keep up with the pace of information of our customers. But each of those challenges represents opportunities for us, opportunities for everyone here to learn and respond faster than the people around them. The world has changed. The old models no longer work. We stand at the brink of the biggest change in how companies work because of technology, because of the pace of change, the biggest change since the Industrial Revolution. And you may think this is only for the CEOs to figure out, but it is actually people, individuals within companies like you, at every level of the company, that are going to lead the charge. It's people that are willing to agitate for change, people that are eager to question the status quo. But it is not always easy. Last week, I was talking to a friend of mine, it's a true story, and I said to them, you know, sometimes I have this nagging feeling like I am on the verge of failure. And she said to me, of course you do. That's what it means to push the boundaries. That's what it means to experiment. Well, inaction is no longer a viable option. If you here are worried about being disrupted, then you will need to take action. You will need to be the disruption yourself. Thank you very much.
All right, so what took 10 years took 5 years, what took 5 years took 1 year. And in those increments, double the amount of stuff came out and double the amount of stuff happened. So how do we keep up with all this change? Well, you've heard it. In fact, someone tweeted, by the way, and his tweet read, Galen Ditchburn, yeah? Edison quote, why no Tesla quote? We build but to tear down, Nikola Tesla. All right, so how do we keep up? Well, it's about doing stuff and doing it regularly. Do you guys know about the marshmallow challenge? A few of you do, right? This is a design challenge, and I loved it every time when I first saw it. So Tom Wujek does a TED talk on the marshmallow challenge. And the marshmallow challenge is pretty simple. Teams of four build a tower with marshmallows, with a marshmallow, 20 sticks of pasta, some string, and some tape. And four people get in a room, they get 18 minutes to build the tallest marshmallow structure. It's all about collaboration and all that sort of mumbo jumbo, right? So Tom has watched 70 of these experiments happen. And do you know who the biggest failures are in this experiment, almost the biggest failures? It's usually the business students and the CEO types. The ones that always succeed in having the biggest tower, these guys. Kids, kindergarten kids. Why? And there's a TED talk on this that I highly recommend you go and look at. Why? Because business leaders, typically, old school ones, I'm aware my MD is in the room, so not her, but business leaders, they have a vision for that 18 minutes and a goal for that 18 minutes. And we're going to set a direction and everyone's got a task and we're all going to go and do it. And we'll course correct and we'll manage and we'll get it all done. And then they hopefully get the best tower of them all. You know what kids do? I just build 20 towers. They just start building. That didn't work. All right, another tower. Building. That kind of worked. Stick it on top of that. Ah, fell over. And keep going and going and going. Kids rapidly build things. Kids rapidly deploy. When you can deploy 2,000... when you can deploy 2,000 surfers at the click of a button. When... do you know Xbox Live, for example? You know how many servers run Xbox Live right now? 15,000 servers run Xbox Live. Do you know how many are going to run it on Xbox One? 300,000. When you could do that in a short amount of time, when you could put any server you want, just click a button and you've got instances. When MYOB could take a desktop app and put it in the cloud in the space of months. When Halfbrick and Rovio are building at such a rapid rate. When Car Sales is building in 5 weeks. When Project Tripod has an idea 2 months ago and now they're about to launch. They're all building marshmallows. That's all they're doing. They're building stuff at the same rapid rate. And that's the trick, because do you know why? And Adam talked about it. Failure is now cheap. It costs you so little to fail. You have an idea, you want to fire up a bunch of servers or a dev test environment and see whether it works? You do it, you click a bunch of buttons, you run it for a couple of days, you shut it down. What's it cost you? Not much. So failure is now cheap. That is the way you keep up with the pace of the technology, by just doing stuff over and over and taking ideas and executing them. You are empowered to do so in a disruptive world. Like over the next 4 days, you guys are going to drink roughly 10,000 cans of soft drink and roughly 40,000 cups of coffee. I ask you one thing, harness that caffeine. Take that caffeine and do stuff with it. Participate in things like the September of Apps. Take that caffeine and start to do things. Use your Azure subscription. This wasn't very popular with you kids, I've noticed. So use your Azure subscription. Sign up for your Azure subscription and learn more about Azure. If you haven't done it, you could win a Surface Pro. Make sure you come back and listen to Scott. Scott's got some awesome tales to tell about the engineering of Azure, but also the cool stuff that people are doing with it locally. And every time you hear him talk, and I haven't spoken to Scott about this at all, but I guarantee you he'll talk about the speed with which everyone he's going to talk about has done it with. And you guys are that everyone. So with that, so by the way, in that showcase area, there's a dev den, and there's a whole bunch of cool technology to play with. It's a den octagon, more than anything, you'll see when you get there. So go hang out there and learn and talk to people who are doing this stuff at the same rapid rate. So, build 10 apps, not one. Deploy more than one server. Do it daily. Operate at the same speed as the technology. That is what you're now able to do. That is what you must do. And it is now time to do it. So with that, please enjoy your tech ed.